This is Main Street on Pray Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today we're going to hear from Minot State, where they're holding a science Olympiad today. Ashley Thornburg will interview Bob Crackle, associate professor of chemistry, who's helping run those kids around the Olympiad up there. And we'll also, of course, have our Dakota Date book. Merrill Pepcorn checks in every day with an interesting slice of history. But we're going to really start today with an important and large slice of history for Minnesota and North Dakota. We're going to talk with three scholars about the U.S.-Dakota War. It took place between 1862 and 1864 in Minnesota and what was then Dakota Territory. And with us to talk about it, a familiar voice to those of you who listen to Prairie Public, Professor Tom Ezern, who teaches history at NDSU. He's also the director of the Center for Heritage Renewal. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Richard Rothus is with us as well. He's an archaeologist and historian with Trefoil Cultural and Environmental. Thank you, Richard, for joining us. And Tamara St. John, archivist with the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. That's Sisseton Wahpeton Nation or Tribe. I'm using the word correctly, I hope. Tom, we're going to start with you. What is the Center for Heritage Renewal?
Oh, that's easy. With a canned answer, it's a little applied research office at NDSU that deals with matters of historic preservation and heritage tourism. We deal with our past in, you might say, a useful way.
Okay. And Richard, you're identified as the lead scholar on this effort, this partnership between Tom and you and Tamara, that is the Sisseton Wahpeton Tribe, NDSU, and Trefoil Cultural and Environmental, your business. Tell us about the importance of the U.S.-Dakota War. Why this subject?
Well, it's a timely subject, of course, because we're at the 150-year anniversary, but also it's a very important subject for the opening up of the Dakota Territory. The war is the prelude to settlement in this area, and it's the prelude to the later, what people sometimes call the Great Sioux War, with Battle Little Bighorn and all that. But this is the beginning. This is where it all starts, and it changes everything pretty much forever out here.
Tamara, give us the perspective of the Sisseton Wahpeton Tribe.
Well, right now, I work for and with the Tribal Historic Preservation Office, and I am, as you said, our archivist. And a part of our mission statement is actually to maintain control or take control of our cultural heritage by telling our own stories. And often this being such a huge focus now in this anniversary period, in the past, our story, our perspective has not been made clear and shared. And part of it is to be present and be proactive and to tell our story from our perspective.
Tom, the word reconsideration is used in the description of your work. Apply that. Tell us why.
It's something historians always do, of course. We're always churning back through old facts and putting them together into new patterns. But there's an opportunity here now, we think, 150 years after these pivotal events, to bring, shall we say, different voices as well as new evidence and different perspectives appropriate to our times, to something to a general array of topics that so much has been written about, but maybe not much knowledge accrued about.
Huh. Richard, set the scene. Take us back to 1862. What was going on, and why did this get out of hand?
1862, over in Minnesota, the Dakota people have been concentrated into a very small strip of land on the south side of the Minnesota River. Very quick transition from being a people who could wander from Minnesota all the way as far west as Montana to living in a small area. Tensions are high. Food is in short supply. Lifestyles are changing. And it's increasingly apparent to the Dakota in Minnesota that the U.S. government policy is that they're going to take this land. There's just no doubt about it anymore. You get young men. Things flare up very quickly. There's a lot of conflict with the settlers, mostly Germans, who have come in and have occupied territory that just a few years ago had been Dakota villages, burial grounds, other things. It's a tinderbox. And when it flares, it's the Dakota population and the Euro-American population that is there, and the federal government is watching. And I have no doubt they knew this was going to happen. It's pretty clear.
Tamara, the issues or the circumstances of the time indicate that there was a lot of hunger among the Native Americans who were there at the time, and that there was also a lot of frustration with the government over treaties that had been violated. So set the scene for the Dakotans who were in that area at the time.
Certainly. That's a very important part, and that even by my own education, my own experience, it has often been missing. The story of 1862 in Minnesota history, Dakota, often starts with 1862 and the so-called Minnesota Uprising, something that we refer to now as the Dakota Conflict or the Dakota War of 1862. And one of the factors, one of the biggest factors in it, was the level of starvation and the fact that we were no longer able to sustain ourselves in the manner that we had. One of the most telling of documents I found was Sarah Wakefield, who was the wife of the doctor there at Lower Sioux. And she talked about the starvation that she saw, and as they were waiting for annuities, and that there were deaths occurring, children, babies that were dying, and that they were struggling to. We have oral history that talks about the starvation, the trying to eat bark or to chew on leather to survive. She said that I saw with my own eyes that struggle, and that they were eating the soft parts of the marshy grasses. It was a terrible time. And certainly those things are a factor in what comes to pass.
Well, what kind of relationship existed between those Dakotans who were in that area and the settlers? Was there fear or, anger between them, or was there real concern?
It's a very complicated part of that history. And some of the things that I found, there really are no black and white in all of it as to what the relationships were. There were people, I think, that didn't have a difficult relationship. There were even friendships, I think, between the settlers and some of the Dakota families, particularly those that were the so-called mixed bloods and those that were a part of the traders, the fur traders, those type of families. There was some of the stories later of the orphans of 1862, the children of the settlers, that had lost their parents in that terrible time. And one of the little girls had said, while she was held prisoner at Camp Release, that the Indian woman that used to come and bake bread with my mother wouldn't look me in the eyes. That said to me that her mother, her settler mother, had a relationship with this Dakota woman where they even baked bread together. And later on, she said that she was being cared for by a family and kept within that teepee or that lodge. And when they gave her food, they fed her well, and that she had asked for, she said, mini skuya, meaning in Dakota language, that she wished to have salt for her food. And later on, she talked about how she had saw people there walking about the camp, and she saw a man in what she said was white man's clothing, and she thought for a minute that it was her father, and she ran to him crying, and it was an Indian man, a Dakota man, and he had picked her up, and he knew, what sort of state she was in, and she said to him, she was crying and said, mie tipi, meaning she wished to go home. So that was one story that said so much to me about that it really wasn't black and white as far as relationships go, and that there were some that were good relationships, although certainly in the bigger picture it was a terrible time. And it sort of leads into where the impact of this event, this period of time, just reached out to many different people in many different ways. And so it's important to acknowledge all of those, including the orphans and certainly the children that died from starvation. There are many different perspectives.
Well, we need to talk about the aftermath, and we'll do that in a few minutes. But I want to get, again, we had this incident involving four Dakotans killing five white settlers. But how did that become a war?
Initially, the decisions as whether to fight or not are happening at a very local level. So there are bands of Dakota. Some choose to fight. Some choose not to fight. There was a lot of debate about it. And this is also true with the Euro-American settlement. Some people decided to stay and fight. Many people had no idea what was going on and were caught up in it. Some people decided to flee. So it gets large enough that the militia and the towns have to gather together forces. Governor Ramsey and others are, of course, become involved
in Minnesota.
And by the time the war gets to Dakota territory, we have Union troops, regular army out here pursuing it.
So it's really escalated. It's gotten the attention of President Lincoln.
Absolutely. The hangings of Mankato are an issue that has presidential attention. And it's something that was on the agenda. This is not a complete surprise to the federal government and to the various government agencies. This was on the list of things that was going to happen.
Well, when we think of these kinds of conflicts, inevitably I kind of go to the stereotypes has been presented by Hollywood for decades in the old Western movies. But let's talk about the actual nature of this war. How were these battles actually fought? Is there an archetypal battle in the U.S. Dakota War?
I think you can split them into two types. The initial battles, the Dakota warriors have the initiative. When things start, when the town of New Ulm in Minnesota, for example, is attacked, they are in a defensive posture. They're caught by surprise. The Dakota warriors have the initiative. They have control of what happens there. Once General Sully and experienced troops who have been out in the Civil War show up, that sort of flip-flops where they are, to a certain extent, marching into territories and forcing the issue. So I think there are two different types of battles. There's local battles, New Ulm, where it's the settlers versus their neighbors, the Dakota who are close by. And then there's the larger battles involving the military, so that Whitestone Hill or Killdeer Mountain in North Dakota, for example.
Well, when you archaeologically excavate a possible battle site, are you looking for arrowheads or lead?
Yes.
Both.
It's one of the problems with doing archaeology on these sorts of battle sites. We can find lead and bullets with metal detectors. Arrowheads, much harder to find. Metal detectors won't work on them. There has not been very much archaeology of the Dakota War done yet. We're getting started on that. But it's been woefully neglected. It hasn't been studied that way very much.
Well, we're speaking about the U.S. Dakota War. It took place 150 years ago, between 1862 and 1864, in the Minnesota River Valley and Dakota Territory largely. And we're talking with Richard Rothfuss. You just heard him, an archaeologist and historian with Trefoil Cultural and Environmental. Tamara St. John is an archivist with the Sisseton Wahpeton Tribe. And Professor Tom Ezern, a familiar voice on Prairie Public, joins us as the director of the Center for Heritage Renewal, which is kind of steering this operation. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for this program is provided by the North Dakota Education Association, an organization of 8,000 school employees working to ensure great public schools for every child.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with Andrea Bocelli, Love in Portofino. Then at 9 Central, Il Vovo takes flight. The trio of Italian tenors perform at the Detroit Opera House. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and in the background, echoes from Mallorca with the Beale Ballester Trio. That's their CD, Echoes from Majorca. All right. We're speaking about the U.S.-Dakota War. Professor Tom Ezern is with us, Richard Rothas, and Tamara St. John. And when we left off, we were talking about, you know, trying to reconstruct what happened on some of these battlefields. So, Richard, your area is archaeology. How do you go about where – do you know where the battle sites are? And if you do, 150 years later, what are you doing to find out about what actually happened?
We certainly know where most of them are, although there are many, many small skirmishes out there that aren't well known. One of the first things we'll do is a topographic analysis, a battlefield analysis. I've worked in New Ulm right now with North Dakota State University and Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. We're doing a survey of the Fort Abercrombie battlefield. That's been funded by the American Battlefield Protection Program. And step one is a fairly standard military analysis. It's called COCOA, and we're mapping out avenues of approach, points where there are good visibility, matching it up to the documentary record, and then also matching it up with what we know about the fighting styles of the people involved. The Dakota warriors fight very differently from the U.S. soldiers. So,
give us a brief description of that. What do you mean by differently?
The U.S. soldiers are trained, although at the beginning we have some very poorly trained soldiers out here. There is a big civil war going on. They tend to think in terms of pitched assaults, fortified positions, winning battles, whereas the Dakota warriors are they come out of a tradition of Plains Indian tradition that goes back thousands of years, where they never fought pitched battles. Battles existed. They had a purpose. A lot of it was related to individual honor, scaring your enemy, maybe getting some goods like some horses. But the idea of sieging a town or a village or trying to kill the majority of people in there, that simply didn't exist. They did not fight that way. So
when they say the Battle of New Ulm and the Second Battle of New Ulm, what kind of a fight was that?
The town folks of New Ulm, many of whom, and they're Germans, many of them were involved in the revolutions in Germany. They're street fighters. They know how to fight. They fortify the streets, barricade them as best as they can. They hold the position, and the Dakota make attacks and basically try to convince the New Ulmers to leave, because that's a standard approach for the Plains peoples is you if someone's too close to your territory, you want them to leave. You know, the goal isn't exterminate them, just make them leave. So they keep hitting New Ulm with attacks, trying to sneak in, get through the barricades without doing a pitched battle with many fatalities. And I've been saying that actually the Dakota won the Battle of New Ulm, because at the end, the New Ulmers, they pack up. And they leave. They go away. They come back. So I think we can say the Dakota won the battle. But, of course, we know the war ends very differently.
Tamara, what kind of records does the tribe have of this?
Well, I think the tribe, we probably deal more with oral history when it comes to some of these stories. A point that's sticking in my mind as Richard is talking, that a lot of the battles that we are now focused on with the anniversary of the Civil War and 1862, from the Dakota perspective, it isn't always a military force engaging a military force. And, for example, at Whitestone Hill, and this year is a very important year for Whitestone Hill, September of 1863, and this year we really will be trying to do something that respects the descendants of those that lost their lives there or the survivors of Whitestone Hill. But in that particular so-called battle, the Dakota perspective is that it was a massacre. And again, not a military force engaged in a military force, but women and children. And it shows in the study there, the items that I found at the Smithsonian that were a result of Whitestone Hill, collected by Colonel Furness, were domestic items. There were things like a wooden spoon, a rattle, either a child's rattle or maybe a ceremonial type of an item. So sometimes these things are not the traditional type of warfare. I think on the tribal perspective, you know, we always have to consider that it looks very different to us looking back.
Tom, the nature of warfare is that there are people with weapons who go at each other, and then there are people back home who, you know, maybe cook the meals and take care of the kids. They're combatants and non-combatants. Did that hold true for the U.S. Dakota War?
I think not, and we're in the middle of the 19th century and the beginning, we might say, sad to say, of modern warfare, which means total war. And that line between combatants and non-combatants gets blurred at best and often is absent. When a commander, and Alfred Sully would be the classic case of this, say what you will of him, I think he thought clearly as to what he was going to do, and that was to wage total war, destroy the capacity of the perceived enemy to fight.
So break their spirit, not just kill them, but break them.
Exactly.
I would add to that in the records of Whitestone Hill and Killdeer Mountain, which is another one that we're going to be working with, that the scorched earth type of tactic where after the so-called battle, and again on our end, massacre, they had destroyed by burning all of the teepees, the teepee poles, the meat that punched holes in the cooking gear, really in order to leave the people destitute for winter and unable to sustain through the elements. So those sort of tactics are, I think, really resulted in more deaths than any bullet or gun.
Richard, are the records of the conflict different depending on the heritage of the combatant?
Very much. And from battle to battle, who was there? For many of the events in Minnesota, we have just spectacular records. New Ulm is the prime example. I like to joke that the German population there was so good at recording things that as people were dropping behind the barricade, someone was there asking them a few questions before they died to make sure that everything was in the record. When we get out to Killdeer Mountain or Whitestone Hill, there is no Euro-American population there. All the Euro-Americans involved in those battles, for the most part, disperse. They're soldiers. They don't settle there. So we don't have those local accounts that are written down. That, of course, makes the information that's available in oral histories that much more important. I wish I could say we have hundreds of soldiers' diaries, but we don't. These are soldiers who were already tired of war. When they were done, they left. Many of them never wrote about it or thought about it again.
But this reconsideration project allows perhaps an enhanced communication between the tribal records and those written records that do exist on the historian side.
Absolutely, and it helps us enhance the way we do history and interpret it also because of the sources what we are using. We're embracing the idea that the Dakota, the native warriors, they were actors. They weren't simply people to whom these events occurred. They're making decisions and very hard decisions about who does what and what they're going to do.
We're talking about the U.S. Dakota War 150 years ago. It took place in the Minnesota River Valley and moved into Dakota Territory. And we're talking with Professor Tom Easer and Richard Rothus and Tamara St. John, three scholars who are helping to, reconsider this important piece of history for the Upper Midwest. And we'll be back with them after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. State Senator Tony Grinberg says there are serious troubles with the Board of Higher Education. He won't name names, but the Fargo lawmaker says there's a big disconnect between the legislature and the board when it comes to moving the university system forward, and he thinks some members should consider stepping down. Board member Grant Shaft is not surprised by the comments, chalking it up to tensions created by the different roles lawmakers and the board play when it comes to funding and long-term planning for higher education.
Of course, you know, I was president during the Fighting Sioux issue, and I think that suggestion was made of me almost on a daily basis. So there's a mechanism for board members if they were to be removed. It's a process that's in the Constitution, but I don't see any intention on the part of any board members to step down at this time.
Schaff says he believes a majority of the legislature supports what the Board of Higher Education is doing. Governor Dalrymple is asking the Senate Education Committee to restore the K-12 education funding formula bill back to its original version. The bill makes more state money available to local schools, and its sponsors say it will provide significant property tax relief. The House changed the original bill. It now requires local school districts to levy 70 mills. The original bill required a 50-mill local property tax effort. That will reduce the state's funding by $120 million. Dalrymple told the committee he doesn't understand the House's reasoning. He says this bill is the best way to provide substantial property tax relief.
Why? Because we are already footing the majority of the bill for K-12 education. We are already in a partnership relationship with school districts on school funding. We already have a good understanding of how the governance is going to work. And we can go further with that. And we can, for the first time in state history, actually talk about a true limitation on local taxing authority. Never happened before.
The bill doesn't have the money in it. It only lays out the formula. The committee did not take immediate action as it waits for amendments. And Republican leaders in the Minnesota legislature are ramping up their criticism of Governor Mark Dayton's proposal to increase income taxes to the wealthiest 2% of Minnesotans. This follows Dayton's decision to drop a controversial state sales tax expansion. House Minority Leader Kurt Dowd says many small businesses would be harmed under the governor's income tax plan.
We just think that right now is the wrong time to be taxing job creators. And all of us say out on the campaign trail that we want Minnesota to be more competitive for job creation. And we feel like this tax, as well as the business-to-business, make Minnesota less competitive.
DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach says there will be a significant conversation in the session this year about income taxes. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thank you, Danielle. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We're talking about the U.S.-Dakota War with Professor Tom Ezern, Richard Rothus, an archaeologist and historian, and Tamara St. John, an archivist with the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate, the Sisseton Wahpeton Nation. Now, when we left this discussion, we were talking about, I guess, where and what happened and that kind of thing. And we've also talked a bit about the records and the fact that this reconsideration project allows perhaps more of these records to be seen by more people and synthesized and all of that kind of thing. Is there ready access to these records? Tamara, can we go see them at your archive? Can we go visit it?
Well, our archives has we have a lot of records that I think most institutions have, and certainly we are in the process of building a new archives and have a new facility, and we'd really encourage anybody to come to the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. We have a tourism office now, and we invite people to come and see our world a little bit too. But as far as records go, some of the things that I think are important for us are genealogies. My first interest in this history came from genealogy and doing genealogical research for families. And genealogy really forces us as Dakota people to get to know our history. It's an exploration into our culture as far as language, identity, just a wealth of things.
Well, let's now talk about the current progress of this reconsideration, this exploration. Any surprises yet, Richard?
Oh, always a tremendous number of surprises. One of the things that has surprised me most is the wealth of information that is still untapped. We know a lot about many individuals who were involved in these battles and conflicts that hasn't been incorporated into the histories. Most of the histories are very generalized. I think we're very interested in trying to pull that down to community and individual levels. So there's information that no one's really had the ability, and I'm talking about the genealogy there, which Tamara can deal with very handily, or the inclination to pull the stories together.
Let's talk about the end of the combat phase here before we move on to the aftermath, and that is we did have 38 Dakotans hanged at Mankato under literally a presidential order. But others were those executions were stayed for others. Give us that circumstance, Richard. What happened?
There was a military tribunal, and this mostly is carried out very quickly after the events in Minnesota. And there's a military tribunal. It's a very quick rush to judgment. There's some confusion among the tribunal about who they're trying, where they were. So there were several I think it was two – is it 200 who were condemned, 300? And the records went to President Lincoln. He looked through them and he tried to narrow it down to people he could be thought were absolutely positively guilty of doing something pretty awful during the battle. So that's the scenario there. Comes down to 38 individuals, at least one of whom we are quite sure is completely innocent, and the others, it's more complicated.
If I could add to that, I think some of the records that about those trials and such, there's a new book out called The Dakota Prisoner of War Letters, Dr. Clifford Chunku and Reverend Simon. And within it, it really comes from the work with the missionaries. And the Riggs papers had talked about those that were imprisoned at the time. And some of them, by his words, were imprisoned for having just participated in the excitement of the times. One man was an older man who had painted the faces of some of the young men, his sons. And for that, he was tried. There were others that were, for example, Thomas A. Robertson, who was actually an ancestor of mine, who was the courier between Little Crow and General Sibley, and his life in danger from both sides, a part of a mixed-blood family. And he was tried as well. And so the trials, like Richard said, were short. They were, we often say, something of a kangaroo court. And the 38 that were hung, there were many of those, at least one in particular, we know for a fact, by the name of Chuske, who was hung wrongfully. They knew him to have saved the woman I mentioned earlier, Sarah Wakefield, the doctor's wife, and hung there in Mankato. So not a job well done as far as the trials go.
Well, one of those sayings about this kind of thing is that those who win the war get to write the history, and apparently the short version, the version we're contemplating now, is the one that's being reconsidered. Not all Dakotans were anxious to have this fight, and there was some disagreement among tribal groups about whether or not to engage Uncle Sam.
Right. I think that the Sisseton Wahpeton, with our leaders such as Tatanka Naji, our Standing Buffalo, and Scarlet Plume, they were not even in the area at the time, and some of the descendants of those leaders are very careful to point out that when the Soldiers' Lodge went up, where they made this decision to go to war, those that were not present, they didn't have a decision in that. So it isn't necessarily true that Standing Buffalo chose not to go to battle so much as it was that he just was not there and he wasn't present when that happened.
Richard, when the battles were over, there were some decisions that affected where the Dakotas would live from then on. Tell us about the diaspora.
We see a recreation of many of the reservation boundaries. There's also been tremendous trauma to the social structure of the Dakota who were involved in this, family units and extended family.
Shoved out of the area.
They're shoved out. The prisoners and a tremendous number of individuals are taken away down to Crow Creek and other places. So Minnesota was emptied, not entirely, but the intention was that Minnesota would no longer have Dakota in it. And the law stated quite simply in Minnesota, if you are Dakota and you're in Minnesota, you can be shot by anyone
wow.
who wants to.
And how long was that law in effect?
I believe it's still on the books.
Oh, my heavens.
The
legislature's
Act.
In session.
Yes.
Yeah, the Removal Act of 1863. And there has been some discussion on that. But, yeah, we often joke about that now, that we are the Dakota, Sisseton, Wahpeton, and others that are exiled out of Minnesota, and that we, by law, are not supposed to be in Minnesota.
Well, I'm sure glad. I think they're very happy to have the Mattawakan Sioux there. It's a large tax funder.
One of the other things that happens at the end of the conflict in 1864, it's not really an end. We have the Battle of Killdeer Mountain, which is very similar to Whitestone Hill. And what has happened there is some of the Western Sioux, the Teton, Sitting Bull, Gaul, some of those groups who weren't involved in the conflict in Minnesota at all, their winter supplies have been destroyed, their buffalo meat to survive on, their teepees, their lodges, their cooking pots. It's quite clear that 1864 it's an intermission, but the Killdeer Mountain especially is saying very clearly, we're busy now, the federal government, the U.S. troops, we're busy now with something else. We will be back, the message is sent. So it's a prelude to an attempt to completely empty the area of the Native population.
Tom, the Center for Heritage Renewal is holding some Dakota War Program meetings around the region. What's the purpose and when and where?
Well, thanks to a grant from the North Dakota Humanities Council, we'll be holding a series of four public forums around the state, and I'll name those quite quickly here. Friday, the 22nd of March at Sitting Bull College at Fort Yates. These are all at 7 p.m. 22nd of March at Sitting Bull College. 23rd of March, that's Saturday, Watford City High School Media Center, and that's hosted by the Pioneer Museum of McKenzie County. Then on 2 weeks later, on Friday the 5th of April, we're at the Ellendale Opera House, Ellendale, North Dakota. And on the 6th of April, that Saturday, at the Lake Region Heritage Center in Devil's Lake. The purpose of these is, well, it's to get scholars in touch with the public, to talk about what we know and what we don't know about the Dakota War, and what we think about it, what the legacy and the values involved of it are. I can refer people to a website for further information. Go to heritagerenewal.org. That's heritagerenewal.org, and look for Dakota War and Dakota Territory. And finally, I'll mention there are a couple other scholars who will be involved in these forums that different people in different places. LaDonna Allard of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe will be certainly at Sitting Bull College on the 22nd of March, and probably at a later forum also. Dennis Gill, a respected elder of the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate, will be at forums contributing his knowledge also.
Well, you mentioned heritagerenewal.org. I also found some information. I think this was from the Minnesota Historical Society at usdakotawar.org. Lots of information up there that sort of sets the base, if you will. But again, the purpose of the forums is to maybe extract a little more information that because there is still some knowledge out there that historians would like to pick through. And obviously, the more people who show up and participate, the better that outcome will be.
These are free public programs.
So,
sponsored by the North Dakota Humanities Council.
There you go. Well done, Professor Ezerin. And that's Professor Tom Ezerin. He teaches history at NDSU. He's also the director of the Center for Heritage Renewal. And, of course, you hear him every week on Main Street and other Prairie Public outlets with his Plain Folk column. Richard Rothus is an archaeologist and historian with a company called Trefoil Cultural and Environmental, and Tamara St. John is the archivist at the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. Thank you all very much for this, and we hope there's great attendance at your forums. Coming up next, Ashley Thornburg goes to a science Olympiad.
Do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or give us a call on the Main Street toll-free studio line, 888-755-6377.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Medals, judges, coaches, competitors, opening ceremonies. That's the trimmings, of course, of an Olympiad. Well, a handful of regional competitions are going on right now across North Dakota with all the Olympic bells and whistles and one major distinction. Instead of racing to a finish line, competitors are racing towards solutions. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talked with Robert Crackle. He's a chemistry professor at Minot State University, and he joined her from the Science Olympiad.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, you're at Minot State University working on the Science Olympiad?
That's correct. We hold a regional Science Olympiad here every year, and then the top teams from here advance to a state competition at NDSU in April.
So walk me through the Science Olympiad. Is it similar to a science fair?
Not exactly. In science fair, the students do research projects and then present the results of those research projects. In Science Olympiad, there's a number of events. It's between 20 and 25 total events where students are assigned different events, kind of like if you go to a track meet. Some students are assigned to maybe run a couple sprints, others maybe to do shot put and discus. Here the students are assigned to different events in the sciences, and then in each of those events they compete. Some of them are building based, or they might build, in this case, like a vehicle powered by a mousetrap, or a helicopter, and they measure the time aloft. Some of them are more knowledge based. Some of them are more laboratory based. And so it's usually two students, maybe three students from each team that compete in an event. And then the top three places in an event will get medals. And team points are kept as well, and the top-scoring teams go on to the state competition.
So who picks these teams? Is that each school?
That's each school. The teachers, or what are called coaches, they select the students different ways. At some of the schools, they have tryouts. Others, the teachers will select students. And then they're the ones who decide which students to put in which events.
I want to talk a little bit more about some of these events. You know, you mentioned the mousetrap vehicle, but I'm looking at a list of a lot of these, and the forestry, heredity, road scholar, the road we drive on, not the RH road,
right.
Write It, Do It, disease detectives. I want to talk about a couple more of these. How about designer jeans?
Designer genes is based on genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And for that one, there are test questions where they have to apply their knowledge of genetics. They might have to do things like fill in what's called a Punnett square, look for recessive genes and things along those lines. So that one is a genetics type of an event.
Okay, so more of the knowledge-based.
That one is more knowledge-based, yes.
Okay. How about one of the lab-based ones? What would be a good example of that?
A good example of a lab-based one would be, there's one called Science Crime Busters, which is an event for the junior high. And in that one, what they have to do is a number of things. They're given some white powders that they have to try to figure out what the different powders are. They're given pieces of evidence like fibers or hair samples, maybe samples of ink, and then they're given a scenario describing a crime, and they have to carry out laboratory tests on those samples and then identify who the culprit was.
Oh, wow. So really pretty real-world experience for for people going into forensics and other sciences, I imagine.
Right, right.
So are you working with, you know, crime labs, or is this just something that the coaches, as you call them, put together?
Well, the people in charge of the events are a combination of faculty members and some students from Minot State, and then some of the high school teachers or the coaches. And each event has a supervisor who is responsible for getting everything set up, and then we may have one or more assistants in there as well. On some of the building events, the directions and guidelines are very well laid out in terms of these are the parameters that you have to meet. And so then the people who are running the event are mainly responsible for making measurements, recording times, and then they will rank, you know, the places that each team gets.
Okay, and you said each of these teams, the total scores go on to a state competition?
Right. The state competition is at North Dakota State in April.
So how many different regions are competing to go into that state tournament?
There's a total of 5 regions, and I'm not sure if I can name all of them. Minot State, at Bismarck, I think Bismarck State runs it. Dickinson State, Dakota College at Bottineau. And then there's one that is either at Valley City or Jamestown, and I can't remember which location.
Do you know roughly how many participants are coming in each region?
I don't know how many in each region. I can speak about our region.
Okay.
We were scheduled to have 18 junior high teams and 15 senior high teams come and compete today. Because of the weather and the road conditions, we had 3 or 4 teams that weren't able to make it. Mm. So we're at about 12 teams in one and about 15 in the other.
And you said junior high and senior high. Are they right. each doing the same experiments, or are the experiments tailored a little?
The experiments are tailored a little. Some of them are very similar. For example, there's a junior high event called Keep the Heat, where they have to build an insulated device to which hot water is added, and then you look at how well it keeps that temperature, how well does it stay at that temperature. And then senior high has one that's called thermodynamics, where they build the same thing. Now, there's also a test that goes along with that, and the test questions are different for the two. Some are, you know, significantly different. For example, in junior high, there's an event called helicopter, where they build essentially a device that functions as a helicopter, and they have to launch it, and they measure how long it spins in the air. And then in the senior high, something comparable would be something called gravity vehicle, where, again, they measure how long it takes for a vehicle to fall from one location to another location. And so the parameters are very different for those two, but they're related in terms of what types of measurements are being made and so on.
So what's the atmosphere like there?
Oh, it's a lot of fun. It gets hectic right at the beginning. We start with some opening ceremonies, and then the events start at 8:30. And so having all the kids find the rooms where their events are and making sure that everything is set up and we have all the materials we need is very hectic. But after an hour or two, everything tends to be running pretty smoothly.
Are there people there watching these competitions?
There are some, not a lot, but we have some parents will come along and be able to watch certain competitions. Mainly it's just the kids that are in there competing and then the coaches who are checking up to see how things are going and make sure their students have everything they need.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Robert.
Okay, thank you.
The winners received gold, silver, and bronze medals during the awards ceremony, and that state competition in late April is similar to the regionals, but it will have more teams and more events. Coming up on Main Street, Dakota Datebook.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 12th. It's a flock of geese and a murder of crows. But what do you call a large group of town criers? On this date in 1929, the Park Hotel in Kildare was full of them. They had gathered in Kildare for their regular town criers meeting. The Kildare Herald reported that it was a capacity affair. 35 persons were recorded in attendance. The town criers enjoyed a meal, after which the chairman called the meeting to order. Part of the order of business was to discuss what they had accomplished. The newspaper reported, as the last word, Håkon Weidal, in his usual vivid way, portrayed their activities in military parlance, which took in every maneuver from the breakfast bugle of the morning after to the zero hour of the night before. As a climax, he decorated them with a specifically prepared ribbon from each of which was suspended a $5 gold piece. After the business of the meeting was over, the town criers went to the Oddfellow Hall in the Kildare Hotel building, where they played whist, sang, and enjoyed themselves. Their number increased as people around town, including many who were weather-bound in town overnight, at least that was their excuse. The newspaper stated, somewhere long ago, a sad-faced poet who never connived with his friends and acquaintances uttered the following, "Backward, turn backward, O time in thy flight, and make me a child again just for tonight." That gem of thought, confessing the accumulated stagnation of years gone by and expressing a yearning for things that were forever gone, would have never graced the crown of literature if the discouraged old poet had ever attended a party with the Kildare town criers. There are official town crier positions in some cities today, though none in North Dakota. Still, one can imagine the echo of the group of men cheering each other and perhaps even exclaiming out loud, "Hear ye, hear ye." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Wednesday on Main Street, with the debate over gun control at high tide, we'll take the opportunity to visit with Dan Baum. He's the author of the new book, Gun Guys, A Road Trip, an assessment of guns in America from a gun lover that provides a thoughtful corrective, he says, to the mutual ideological hysteria surrounding the issue of guns in America. And Ashley Thornburg also has something special for us tomorrow.
That's right. I talk with Belgian director Tom van Overmaat. He stops by to talk about the fantastical worlds that he creates in some of his films, including Death of a Shadow. It is the Oscar-nominated film that just took top honors at the Fargo Film Festival. It really is a tremendous film. And he has some interesting things that he takes into account when he goes about making a film.
He didn't win the Oscar, but I have to say, I've seen that film, and it's very impressive technically and visually. It's a feast, as a matter of fact, and a very intriguing story that was told. So if you have a chance, I think you can go online and probably look at Death of a Shadow. It's worth it.
There is a trailer on YouTube.
Okay. Well, you'll see what we mean if you go up to YouTube and check out that trailer. In the meantime, we'll be back on Main Street tomorrow, and you have a great evening.